From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. College graduates who entered the workforce soon after the recession ended are still feeling its effects. Fewer jobs, lower wages. We ask a labor economist how their earnings potential has been cut and find out what the outlook is for this year's graduates. And we listen in as an aspiring 2015 college graduate asks a 2011 graduate about the challenge of the job hunt. Then, what can bullets, buttons, and beams buried in the ground tell us about the people in the War of 1812? We talk with archaeologists Julie Shablitsky and Michael Lucas, co-editors of a new book about the war. Plus, our film mavens Anne Hornaday of the Washington Post and Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival tell us what movies we've got to catch before the end of summer. First, the news.
I'm producer Jamila Kay. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WIPR.org. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to talk some more about jobs now. The unemployment numbers we just heard on the national news give us an overall jobs picture. We want to home in now on a particular segment of the workforce, young workers, specifically recent college graduates. Millions of college graduates have entered the workforce since the recession ended in 2009. It's been 5 years since the economy stopped shrinking, but job prospects for new grads have not improved. And researchers have found that graduating in a post-recession economy has effects that could ripple through the life of the young worker's career. What are those effects? When are things likely to improve for recent graduates? In a few minutes, we're going to put those questions to a noted economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. First, we want to hear from someone who has experienced firsthand the effects of graduating in the aftermath of the recession. Maureen Harvey is a former intern with WIPR's news department. She graduated from UMBC in 2011 with a degree in political science and has yet to secure a full-time job. We thought who better to talk to Maureen about her experiences than Maryland Morning's intern Justina Latimer, who will graduate from Towson University next spring. Here's part of their conversation.
What industry were you hoping to get into after you graduated?
Immediately after, I was sort of hoping to get into the political science field, do some type of internship that would help me either work for a politician or somebody in the federal government or work for some type of think tank or even a nonprofit. I did an internship in Annapolis with the Maryland Democratic Party. So after that, I ended up going back to school for a little bit.
So you went right back to school after you graduated or?
Well, so I graduated in 2011, and then I think maybe in 2012, I went to Howard Community College and I started taking some radio production classes as to learn about journalism. Because that's what I found out that I was really interested in.
Once you graduated, did you apply within the journalism field for a job or?
Well, I sort of applied for broad communications types of jobs, public relations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've applied for a lot of different types of jobs. Anything that I think that I am sort of qualified for, I'll go for. I mean, just getting that job at the mall, I mean, it was hard just to get a retail job.
Are you comfortable with sharing, how much per hour you were making, under 9, under 10?
Well, when I started, I was working minimum wage.
Okay.
But I was there for almost 2 years, and by the end of it, I was making under 10.
And when you were in your senior year of college, did you picture yourself 3 years later where you are now? Or did you think you would be somewhere else?
I'm really good at school. I'm really good at being in a very structured environment and figuring out, okay, you do this, this, and this, and the next year you do that. I didn't really have very much of a plan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that anybody really emphasized to me what was coming. And there isn't a class in college about how to get a job.
Maureen Harvey, former intern with WIPR's news department, speaking with Justina Latimer, an intern now with Maryland Morning. And now to discuss this in more depth, I'm joined by Heidi Shierholz, who follows the labor market as an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
How does Maureen's experience compare with the overall experience of graduating in this economy?
It's very typical. What we know is that workers who have the misfortune to be born at a time that then drops them into the labor force as new workers when the economy is very weak, it means they're less likely to have good outcomes than they would otherwise. They're more likely to face a period of earnings instability, employment instability. It's harder to find a job that uses their degree, say if they have a college degree. It's just, in general, the weakness of job opportunities, the lack of jobs out there, means a larger share of a cohort who enters during a weak period is actually going to do poorly than they would otherwise if they'd been lucky enough to enter during a strong expansion.
Three months ago, you published an analysis titled "The Class of 2014, The Weak Economy is Idling Too Many Young Graduates," which looked at graduates' unemployment and underemployment going back to before the start of the recession. Tell us what you found.
We found big increases in unemployment for all groups of young people, so groups with of young people with a high school degree who are starting their careers, not enrolled in further schooling. You see big increases in unemployment for those groups. You also see big increases in unemployment for people with college degrees. So workers with college degrees, young people with college degrees, do better than workers without one, but no group has been spared from the weak labor market in the aftermath of the Great Recession. All groups have seen deterioration in job opportunities and lower wages, higher unemployment, higher underemployment.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Heidi Shierholz, economist with the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking about the job market for post-recession graduates. Can we put some numbers on this? I mean, either as a percentage or in dollar terms, what is the earnings gap that graduates from 2009, 2010, 2011 experience as opposed to somebody who graduated back before 2006 when the recession started?
A rule of thumb on this is that every percent increase in unemployment causes a wage penalty. You get lower wages than you otherwise would have of around 6 to 7%. So if the unemployment rate is 3 percentage points higher now than it, or you know, earlier in the recession, it was 3 percentage points higher than it was before the recession hit, that would be an earnings penalty of around 20%.
And how long does this last? I mean, the coverage of it uses phrases like long-term and lifetime to describe the effects of entering this job market post-recession.
Yeah, it lasts a long time. I refer to it as a scarring effect, meaning it really sticks around. So some of the best evidence shows that people will actually, most people eventually get back on to the trajectory that they would have been on if they'd been lucky enough to enter the labor market when job opportunities were strong. But it takes a very long time. So 10 years, 20 years to get back on to where they would have been if the labor market hadn't been bad when they'd entered.
How about graduates in 2013 or 2014 or even the class of 2015? Has the tide turned for them?
They are much better off than their older brothers and sisters that graduated in 2009. So the labor market is improving. We are measurably better than we have. There are measurably better job opportunities now than there were, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago. So that's the good news. The bad news is that it's still very weak.
So what can these graduates do to change the direction of how their careers are going?
These young people today need to hang really tough. They need to know, listen, it's going to be harder for you than it would have been if you'd been able to graduate in, say, 2007. It's going to take longer to find a decent job. You may have to settle for something that's not quite as good as what you otherwise would have gotten. And just hang in there. Know that it's not your fault. And then the other thing that's maybe a little more actionable is one of the ways that young people see advancement in the labor market is to be open to change, be flexible. One of the ways you see growth is through changing jobs. maybe even changing cities, being open to changing careers. So those kinds of movements can be the things that help you get back on to that happy trajectory you would have been on if you'd been lucky enough to enter the labor market when things were strong. And so that is, I think, young people can help themselves out by not necessarily right in the beginning, but over the course of the next decade, just be open to various forms of mobility in order to nudge yourself perhaps more quickly to that happy trajectory.
Heidi, thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Heidi Shierholz is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute. We have a link to the Institute's research and to a podcast at Slate.com called Negotiations Academy, including a session on how to negotiate salary. We also have a link to Maureen Harvey and Justina Latimer's stories for WYPR and more of their conversation. More of this interview, too, all at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks to our intern, Justina Latimer, for help with this segment. She'll be leaving us next week, back to school. We're looking for fall interns right now. Do you want to help us make radio? Do you dream of Maryland in your sleep and then wake up and think about it some more? You could be part of our team this fall. We've got all the details you need to apply at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead on Maryland Morning, the physical record of the war in Maryland 200 years ago this month. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. No doubt, crickets chirped and birds warbled in Maryland's fields in August 1814, but underneath the lazy sounds of deep summer, there was tension and confusion. The British had opened a new front in the war that had started in 1812, predatory raids around the Chesapeake region to disrupt commerce and create alarm among the people. Battles in Prince George's County, Baltimore County, and on the Eastern Shore led to the confrontations we've read about, the British burning the White House and Library of Congress in Washington on August 24th, and 3 weeks later, the bombardment of Fort McHenry. A new book is being published that alerts us not to the written history of the War of 1812, but to what we can learn from the physical remains, the lay of the land, the artifacts, what archaeology can add to the narrative we thought we knew. The book is simply Archaeology of the War of 1812. It's edited by two Marylanders. Julie Shabliski is chief archaeologist of the Maryland State Highway Administration and leader of its cultural resources section. Welcome back to the show, Julie.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Michael Lucas, who just left the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, where he was research director for archaeological field projects. Now he's curator of historical archaeology at the New York State Museum. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Now, Julie, you write about advances in archaeological techniques that essentially make archaeology more powerful, that are pulling more of the story out of the ground. What kind of advances?
Well, we're really looking at hard science in this case. So, for example, remote sensing, ground-penetrating radar, which is simply the ability to send rays through the soil and have them bounce back up and be able to tell us whether we have something buried there. It might be cultural, it might be natural. Also, GIS. I mean, looking at mapping, superimposing.
GIS is Geographical
Information System.
Uh-huh.
And that allows us to superimpose modern maps, the landscape today, on old historic maps and try and figure out, for example, where did the troops line up? Where should we look? that really kind of takes a really large, busy landscape of today and gives us a smaller area to search.
Michael Lucas, what would you highlight as news, as this just in from the War of 1812?
Well, in terms of the book and some of the things that were that are talked about in the book, I think one of the things that, and this kind of highlights what archaeology can really add to the story that really historical documents don't. A lot of times things were done that weren't written down. And one example, the article by Charles Cheek, Balicki, and Orr talks about Fort McHenry, where they dug a defensive trench that was rapidly dug and then filled in right after the bombardment of Fort McHenry. And that's something that we wouldn't have known about if it wasn't for archaeology. And it brings that story to a human level, where the troops were huddled down in the trench, and it's something that, while they withstood this bombardment by the British, and it's something that we wouldn't have understood if it wasn't through archaeology. So that's one example.
On Maryland Morning 88.1, I'm Sheila Cast, talking about the archaeology of the War of 1812 with two Marylanders who edited the book of that name. Michael Lucas headed archaeological field studies for the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission in Prince George's County. And Julie Shablitsky is chief archaeologist of the Maryland State Highway Administration. Julie, your chapter in the book details the Battle of Cox Field on the eastern shore, fought early in the morning of August 31st, 1814. You say it's the best preserved War of 1812 battlefield in Maryland.
Absolutely. I never knew what I was going to find when we went out there. It's been in a farm field for the last 200 years, as far as we know. And no one really knew if anything survived. So I took a team of archaeologists out there, and we canvassed the field where we thought it could be. I mean, there's been a monument there since 1902, so we more or less knew the approximate location of Cox Field, the Battle of Cox Field.
And what is it close to, by the way?
It's close to Chestertown.
Uh-huh.
So Chestertown on the eastern shore of Maryland. And when we went out there, we began metal detecting. So as soon as we began sweeping the ground, we ended up getting hits. So we were finding lead shot, 62, 69 caliber. 62 caliber we knew came from American muskets, while 69 caliber muskets would have fired a little bit larger caliber musket balls. So we were looking for those sorts of items that could tell us troop locations. We also found dozens of buttons that would have been fallen and ripped from their uniforms. So all these artifacts were used to pinpoint the troop locations, as well as understand what the battlefield boundary is. We never really knew exactly where X marked the spot. We knew it was somewhere in the battlefield, but what archaeology gave us, it gave us troop locations, it gave us the battlefield boundary, and it really helped us get closer to that story.
You also write that it was a slave who led the British to the Americans?
Yes. The day before, Captain Sir Peter Parker, the British commander, landed a troop of men there to burn Richard Frisbee's farm. And at that time, he liberated four enslaved African Americans, in a sense, took them with him on the ship. And one of those men was brave enough to share that he knew where Lieutenant Colonel Philip Reed's, the Maryland militia commander, was camped. And that's when Peter Parker took it upon himself to land his men and find the location of that camp.
And what happened to that African-American?
The next morning, they supposedly turned him over to the Americans, and he was supposed to be killed. But somehow he got away, or perhaps someone freed him again, and he went aboard the ship and sailed with the British.
Michael Lucas, you also write about African-Americans who escaped with the British from Prince George's County. You write about Nottingham, in a town that I hadn't heard of in eastern Prince George's County, that apparently was a thriving 100-year-old settlement at the time of the War of 1812, a part of the regional tobacco trade. Who were the African-Americans that you write about escaping?
Well, there were around 4,000 African Americans who escaped during the War of 1812. And in Prince George's County in particular, since the British were on land in the county, there were numerous enslaved African Americans who escaped. And two of them Ben Nichols and Jenny Henson had lived at a plantation called Mount Calvert, which is one of the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission historic sites. So we had found in our research that they had, when the British came up on their way to attack Washington, they had landed at Mount Calvert, and it was during that time when at least Jenny Henson escaped with her husband onto the into the British ranks, and then from there escaped out of the Chesapeake. But we're not sure what happened to Jenny, her husband, or Ben Nichols, who was living around the Nottingham area at the time, and he also escaped. But they probably both came back through Nottingham when the British troops came back from Washington and headed out toward the Chesapeake Bay and eventually to Fort McHenry.
So you both in your chapters write about these fascinating personal stories, and it seems to me that's from traditional written history as opposed to archaeology.
Well, it goes together. Archaeology is anthropology, the study of people, but the thing about historical archaeology, you have to have those written documents. Those point us in the direction, but oftentimes the archaeology can redirect you or confirm, contradict, or contribute to what's been written. You know, we can do that. We can contribute to what's been written. So we use both. I think what's been traditionally done in the history of the War of 1812 is they don't pull on that material culture, the things that have been left behind. So I think what we want this book to do is go beyond the battlefields and look at the time in between. What were the men doing when they were encamped? What were they doing when they were trying to survive? What was it like for them? So this book examines not only the bullets and the buckles and the buttons, but it also examines the teacups they used and the way that they kept themselves warm. So it gets really down to the human piece of the war.
Well, I appreciate you both talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Shablitsky is chief archaeologist at the Maryland State Highway Administration. Michael Lucas headed archaeological field studies for the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission in Prince George's County. He's now curator of historical archaeology at the New York State Museum. The book they edited is Archaeology of the War of 1812. It includes chapters by 13 teams of archaeologists about findings in the Chesapeake region, the Great Lakes region, and the American South. More information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. There's more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.
Producer Jamila Kay. Go to our website to learn more about a segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us this morning on this Friday, the 1st of August, here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. The first Friday of the month means that it's time for our monthly movie mayhem. And this month, we have circled the globe to track down our intrepid movie mavens. Anne Hornaday, the film critic for The Washington Post, joins us from her ancestral home in Des Moines, Iowa. Anne, how are you doing this morning?
I'm great. Thank you.
Good. I'm imagining something like, you know, Blenheim Castle, you know, where Winston Churchill grew up. Do I have this about right?
Family pile. No, nothing grand. It's just beautiful here. It's unbelievably temperate for August in Iowa. I'm thrilled to report.
Very good. Good to hear. And thank you for taking your time away from your family to join us this morning. And Jed Dietz joins us as well. He's, of course, the director of the Maryland Film Festival. And as always, he spends the first week of August, the intrepid naturalist that he is, camped in a pup tent in the woods in Martha's Vineyard, you know, drinking water from the stream and eating pieces of bark and taking time out from that great endeavor to join us for the movie mayhem. Hey, Jed, how you doing?
Good. I did have to fight through a flock of wild turkeys to get here.
There you go. You know, but that's the kind of dedication that we admire, respect, and appreciate. So, Anne, I want to start with a film that people can get on demand. They can find it on Fandor. It's called My America, and this is a project that was generated by Kwame Kwe Arma when he took over as the director of Center Stage here in Baltimore. So for the 50th anniversary, they commissioned a group of playwrights and artists to create these sort of short monologues that answered the question, who are you, America? And this has now been collated into a film by Hal Hartley. How's it hold up as a film?
Oh, it was fascinating. And it, like you said, these are very short monologues. They're usually about 3 or 4 minutes tops. And they've staged them very simply, usually kind of in a bare-bones room. Some of them are accompanied by a sound design element that might give you a clue to where it's happening. So in one of the pieces, it's a store clerk giving his impressions of the ethnic changes that his neighborhood has been going through, and that's accompanied by sort of the sounds of the store. But usually it's just the actor and the words. And you know, I can't even remember now how many pieces that are in this omnibus, but
21, I think.
Is that, yeah, and you know, some are better, you know, there are a few clunkers, but for the most part they're really fascinating, really galvanizing, and they kind of accumulate into a very powerful experience that ends with a magnificent piece featuring Kathleen Chalfant that's just mesmerizing. And it also, I just would love to put a plug in for Fandor, because this is a site that's kind of like Netflix for the rest of us, and it's being overseen by a guy named Ted Hope, who's a fixture, long time venerated fixture on the independent film community. And it's a membership. You subscribe and you really get access to some wonderful, wonderful work. So I encourage people to check it out.
And Jed, you serve on the board of directors of Center Stage. And I remember when these monologues were introduced in September of 2012, before the 2012-13 season, I guess. Some of them were done live in a performance for an audience at Center Stage. And then in other instances, they ran the tape of, I remember Tracy Toms had one, and there were a bunch of really great people. And they were so beautifully, so well received when we saw them for that very first time a couple of years ago. But I guess you as well think that they hold up pretty well when they're collated into this film.
Yeah, it's remarkable, these 21 pieces out of the 50, and I agree with everything Anne said. The other thing I would point out about Fandor is, and this film director, Hal Hartley, so it's just fascinating because he has had this career that goes back couple decades, and he was really the darling of the independent film world when he first hit with movies like Trust and Henry Fool. And he has continued a career that involves lots of experimentation, both artistically and in distribution. And this Fandor is, you know, in this partnership with Center Stage and these wonderful playwrights. I mean, you're talking, you know, Neil LaBute and Christopher Durang. I mean, Lynn Nottage. I mean, there's emerging playwrights too, but major writers that have participated in these pieces. And Hal Hartley, interestingly enough, Toronto Film Festival is one of the major market festivals, has just announced its lineup, and his newest film, Ned Rifle, is going to be in the Toronto lineup. So it's many wonderful pictures. It's thrilling theatrical stuff, and it's really thrilling from a film standpoint, because this is what's happening now in film, which we've talked about before in the air, of these careers being formed in very different ways than they just weren't even possible a few years back.
Yeah, sure. Well, we commend Kwame Kwe Arma and the folks at Center Stage for the conception of this idea, and delighted that people can see this work online at your leisure. You know, good luck to Mr. Hartley and the folks at Fandor for continuing this. And I want to talk to you also about the new Woody Allen movie. You interviewed Mr. Allen for the Post last week. How
power of Mr. Allen's spirits these days. This is his 47th movie. It's called Magic in Moonlight. And he's already well underway into the next one, isn't he?
You bet. I mean, this is his MO lately. It's a very reliable film a year. He's settled into this incredible rhythm of just work, work, work. And again, inevitably, with that kind of an output and that kind of a production schedule, some are going to be stronger than others. And I wouldn't put this in his, you know, the absolute strongest category, but I found it really enjoyable. And the reason why I interviewed him, I mean, you know, I actually, Judd and I happened to see the movie at the same screening, which was on a Monday night. And the movie deals with a lot of his cardinal themes. You know, there's a magician and there's an incipient love story. But in this case, there's a lot of talk about, you know, it centers around this psychic played by Emma Stone, who may or may not be faking, and a wealthy family has taken her under their wing, and a magician played by Colin Firth is enlisted to come in and debunk her. And in the course of his encounter with her, he starts to have doubts as to whether or not she might actually be able to connect with the other world. And so then it starts to engage all of these perennial Woody Allen questions about God and belief and faith. And in this case, you know, he's a famous lifelong skeptic and atheist and deeply critical of organized religion. But this movie I just found to be a little more yielding and a little bit more gentle-natured, to the point where I thought, huh, I wonder if he's changing. And so I called up the people with the movie and said, is he talking? And they said, sure, come on up. And so that was really the focus of my conversation with him. And I guess I'm here to report that, no, he hasn't changed a bit. He's every bit as skeptical and as, you know, anti-organized religion and everything about it. And I said, well, gee, you know, I was sort of detecting a little bit of a give here. And he said, no, that was purely because this is a romantic comedy, and I, you know, it was the genre that called for that tone, not any kind of philosophical change of heart that he had undergone. But it was a delightful conversation. He's a wonderful person to speak with, and I always enjoy my time with him.
Yeah, your piece was terrific, and you got he said a great quote that you ended your piece with. He said, "It's the job of the artist, I think, to try and figure out how to get through life, knowing that the worst is true." Yeah. And if ever there were a great Woody Allen quote, it's that.
I know.
That's really something.
I mean, it is. It's almost like you think it's almost shtick, but it's not. I mean, he really has given this stuff a lot of. And of course, so says a man who's just literally surrounded. You know, I met him at his house, which is just a beautiful place in Manhattan. You know, you could hear the happy sounds of family in the background. I mean, he's really made. You know, he's obviously quite blissful in terms of his domestic life. He said, you know, when I said, how did you like this one? He's like, oh, I never, you know, he said, you know me, I'm never happy. I mean, I think he's always, I don't think he's ever quite entirely comfortable with what he's created as an artist, but I would say that he's a pretty happy guy in terms of his life and where he's gotten to. But, you know, he is suffused with this sort of existential doubt.
And Jed, you've seen the movie Magic and Moonlight. What's your take?
And I would just first say, if Woody Allen isn't happy, he's insane. But I think this movie is really a miss. I think both Colin Firth and Emma Stone, who I love, are either miscast or were given so little direction that they don't have anywhere near as much fun with their characters as they should have. You get a little glimpse of what could have happened with Eileen Atkins, this marvelous stage actor. All that said, you know, it's gorgeous to look at. It's shot on the Riviera. The flowers are beautiful. The clothes are beautiful. Emma Stone's beautiful. I just thought it had no energy and should have had. I agree with what Anne said, because I think that's what the movie should have done, and it just doesn't get there. It was interesting reading Anne's piece about the things that surround him in his life, which are wonderful, because I'm reading the Elia Kazan's letters, and there's this whole colloquy he has back and forth with Tennessee Williams in the late 40s. So they've hit it sort of big on Broadway, but haven't yet hit it big in the movies. Both of them hit it very big in the movies eventually, but Kazan and Tennessee Williams are already worrying about being surrounded by too much and it distracting them from their art. And I frankly think that's happened to Woody Allen.
Yeah, well, you know, he's within spitting distance of 50 movies in 50 years. You know, it's really
it's amazing.
Quite amazing. Yeah.
And some of them just stunning. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I don't know. I would be a little more general. I did feel like this dude had energy, and I thought they were both terrific. I mean, I thought there was a lot of fizz there, and I adored Firth's performance, too. I mean, it was the typical kind of Woody Allen alter ego character, but sort of extruded through the Britishisms and kind of inherent Noel Coward-y persona of Firth, and it kind of created a whole new creature. So I found it to be a little bit more energized and animated than Jed did.
Well, clearly one of you is dead wrong, and to find out the answer who that is, come to our website, WYPR.org, and producer Jamila Kay will decide. That's how we're gonna work this out, all right? If that's
good.
Okay with you. Jed Dietz from the Maryland Film Festival, Ann Hornaday from the Washington Post joining us for the Maryland Morning Movie Mayhem segment here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Ann, let's talk about a movie called Happy Christmas. It's directed by Joe Swanberg. Anna Kendrick, Melanie Linsky, Mark Weber, and Lena Dunham is in it. So this is a kind of a almost 20-something saga, evidently, about somebody who moves in with a writer and her husband who's a filmmaker and their little kid, and they sort of, you know, find themselves. Good movie?
Oh, yeah, it's delightful. And you buried the lead. I mean, the star of the movie is a gentleman named Jude Swanberg, who is, I think, 2 years old and absolutely steals it. He's Joe's real-life son who plays his baby in the movie, and talk about fizz and energy and charisma. I mean, he's the most, it's uncanny, this performance by this child. But Anna Kendrick plays Joe Swanberg's character's sister, who does move in after a heartbreak, and it's over the Christmas holiday, and she's 20, I think in her mid-20s, and she's drinking too much and doing too many other recreational substances, and her life is not together, and of course, the family with whom she's living is trying to get their life off the ground. So it's all about the kind of dynamics between them. And Joe, you know, we were talking about Fandor and Hal Hartley earlier, and Joe Swanberg is another example of a filmmaker who's really carved out this amazing career, both in the way he creates his films and then the way he gets them seen. And on demand, VOD has a lot to do with that too. But it's just he's really perfecting a style of kind of improvised naturalism. It feels very intimate, very real. I mean, my only quibble with this one is that I felt like it was a little unfinished. I mean, it didn't feel 100% fully realized to me. It's a little wispier and unresolved than I would usually feel comfortable with. But
sorry to interrupt, Ann, but we just have a couple seconds left. So, Jed, let me have you weigh in on Happy Christmas as well, just real quick.
I agree with Ann. Joe's been at the festival a lot. Actually, Jude, the 2-year-old star of this movie, has been at the festival a lot.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I've seen him there.
Yeah.
Kids and dogs. And never work with kids and dogs. First rule of show.
Well, except in this case. This is really fantastic. And the sibling from hell story is pretty amazing.
Well, thanks to you both. Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking time out from your time away from the area to be with us on the Movie Mayhem. Appreciate it. Have a good one. We'll see you next month. That's it for us today. We've got links to information about upcoming events that the Maryland Film Festival is putting on, as well as links to Ann Hornaday's reviews and essays in the Washington Post. Come to WYPR.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks to Charlie Esposito for his help from Martha's Vineyard. And thanks to you for joining us. Coming up Monday morning, our resident foodie, Sasha Wohlhandler, will stop by with a list of the 10 things that you must eat before this summer ends. We'll see you Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.